Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Every Wednesday, you and I have an opportunity to meet another woman who has agreed to share her story, her path with us. Today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Linda Baron-Katz. Linda, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Linda, what brings you to Mind Talk today is your experiences of having bipolar disorder, and you've written a book. In fact, you've written two books, one for adults and one for children.
Yes.
Well, what I'd like to start with is just little Linda growing up in Baldwin, New York. Tell us about what it was like for you as a child growing up.
Well, for my early childhood years, I had a happy life. My family and I was happy. My mother was happy. My father was happy. It was a very happy. But by the age of 10, my mother started getting these symptoms and ended up having a nervous breakdown.
And well, before the age of 10, what kinds of things would you do for fun? What kind of play did you engage in?
I remember when I was in second grade, we did a play on Hans Christian Andersen, and I played a pilgrim girl. And my mother, she was very well at the time and happy that I got the role, that she made a special Dutch costume for me.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
That was a very fun time for me. And, you know, she was there for a lot of events and early on. And she even was able to hold down a job. And it was a very happiest time for her. And for my father, too. He was also proud. And I was in yeshiva, an Orthodox Jewish day school. So I got to study Hebrew and English, Bible, and everything. And that's when I started early on being more religious, knowing what things meant and everything.
So it sounds like it was a very warm and comforting environment in which you grew up, both at home and at school.
Yes.
Any siblings, any brothers or sisters?
I have one sister.
Older, younger?
A year younger. We're 13 months apart.
And how was your relationship with your little sister?
Well, right now, it's not in a good place because my sister is seriously suffering from a mental illness, and she is in denial, and she has been hospitalized at least 6 times in the past 2 years.
Oh, my.
And she doesn't listen to me, doesn't trust me, and I tried everything from getting her on AOT, from trying to hire a lawyer to get her a guardian. Nothing helped. I lost both. She's manipulative. I don't know how these judges and lawyers believe her, but she's very smart like that because she knows how to act in front of a court, in front of judges, in front of police. So, you know. And as a result, I wanted her to be a part of my book. And she was really hard set against it.
So it sounds
but
like
she hates mental illness. She hates the idea of mental illness. She hates the subject of mental illness. She hates what I do as a living. So I had to put a change in the book and come up with a fake name. So I used my cousin Sharon mm-hmm. in the book.
You know,
but in the description, it's really my sister that I'm talking about.
I see. It's really hard and it's painful when there's someone who you love and care about and you see that they're struggling and they continue to refuse your help and support.
Yes.
All right. Let's go back to you at 10, because your life changed when you were 10 years old and your mom became ill and your mom was diagnosed with acute depression. Did you understand what that meant at 10 years old?
No, I didn't. But now I think it wasn't just acute depression. I think she had some psychotic episodes too with it.
Well, and you can have psychotic episodes with
yeah.
depression. At 10 years old, your life now is completely different. Your mom, your dad, your little sister, and you, all of a sudden everything is different. How did things change when mom became ill?
Well, my mom was sort of in denial, so she hated to take pills, medicine, and she was hospitalized twice, and my father and mother fought a lot, mostly because of the pills. My mother would purposely forget to take them. My mother would throw them away in the toilet. And this caused friction between my parents. And there were times when I was crying a lot. And I leaned to my sister at the time, but she was upset about it too. So we were, and I was also scared of my mother then. You know, every time I looked at her, I could see two big bumps on her forehead, which really scared me.
What were those two big bumps?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it was really scaring me. My parents' social life changed. My parents did not want me to talk about her mental illness to anyone, so I had to keep it quiet about everything, what was going on in the family. I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't speak about it. And it really affected me. And plus, at that time, I didn't realize how much of an impact it would have on me later in life, but I knew it would have some impact because from then on, I grew up as a depressed person, depressed child.
Well,
and I always had depressive ups and downs ever since through adulthood.
Well, your life completely changed at a very young age, and it sounds like you went from what felt like a warm, loving environment, both at home and in school and with friends, to an environment that was much more closed off, much more scary. You couldn't talk about it at school. Sounds like you didn't have a lot of conversations about it at home either, did you?
No, we didn't. I mean, between my sister, me, and my father, we had to watch my mother take her pills. We actually had to bring her water and open her pill bottle and give her the pills with her water every night because we couldn't trust her. And it was very difficult. You can imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, that's hard enough for an adult to have to deal with, but for a 9 and a 10-year-old to essentially take on the role of parenting a parent when it comes to pill taking, that's got to be really, really hard.
Yeah. Yes. It was very hard and was a really tough, for a couple of years, it was tough. But I think I noticed my mom changed she did change as she got older, but I noticed she really changed when she saw how mental illness started to affect me when I was diagnosed with bipolar.
And how old were you when you were diagnosed as being bipolar?
I was 24.
All right, so between the ages of 10 and 24, though it sounds like your focus, at least at home, was the care of mom.
Yes.
And your sister and your dad, my guess is that your friendships changed. You couldn't talk about anything that was going on at home.
No, I couldn't. It was really hard, you know. If I had a birthday party, I couldn't even say something to my friends or even my closest friends. We all had to keep it quiet. I mean, that was the way in those days at the time, you know, because of the stigma, and stigma was very high during that time.
Yes.
And so, I mean, nobody really opened up about it. Nobody really talked about it. And, you know, it was very hard. What? And my mom, she had to go on disability, and she didn't want to work. She hated work. So she never gone back to work. Although there were times when she thought of it, but she really hated it. So, I mean, and my father was against the idea of her working again because of what happened. So, but for me, I decided that I didn't want to become like my mother, hating the idea of working, because I believe working is recovery in itself.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about high school. I mean, junior high school, college, the myth, if you will, the general thought is that those are the times when your socializing is at its highest. You're going out on dates, you're making new friends, your whole world is filled with openness and discovery. That's the myth about high school and college. What was high school like for you?
I loved the living in Baldwin. Even when after I switched from yeshiva to public school, and even in public school I didn't have that many friends, not as I did in yeshiva. And at that time, I think I was in the 9th grade, my father wanted to move. He got a new job in Salem, New Jersey. And I didn't want to leave Baldwin because it was the place of my childhood. And at that time, I got a little bit sick. I had some problems with my stomach, and a lot of people had said that I suffered from a psychosomatic disorder. And I remember one time in school, because I was sick for 2 weeks, my social studies teacher wanted me to take an open book test, but she warned me not to tell the rest of the class. And when she handed back the test, I kind of blabbed about it that it was an open book. And I felt so guilty that I wrote a letter to my social studies teacher saying how sorry I was and everything. And she sent that letter to the guidance counselor. And the guidance counselor had my parents in, had me in, and they thought that Linda should start seeing a psychologist. So Dr. Nass, who was my mother's psychiatrist, he referred us to a psychologist in Plainview, and I saw her once, and then I was referred to Dr. Andrew Sperling in Fairlawn, New Jersey, whom I saw for a while when I first moved because I was nervous to move. I didn't really want to move. But eventually, I grew out of it, and I was a late bloomer. I had trouble dating, meeting people. I made a few friends, and in my last senior year, I dated this man who I met in high school. And we went out, but I wasn't really that attracted to him. I just wanted to go out with him because I needed someone to go to the senior prom with.
Understood.
And then after I graduated high school, I got accepted to Queens College. I was ready for another move. We moved to Forest Hills, New York. And my first freshman year was good, but I met this man in college, and I liked him from the start. I really liked him. I really was infatuated over him. It grew into an obsession. He didn't feel the same way about me. And there was one time where he didn't talk to me for 3 weeks because I told him I loved him. And it was, I got so depressed on account of him that it really affected my mind. After that, our friendship was not really ever the same, but we stayed in touch little by little. Sometimes he would talk to me on the phone. And then after I graduated college, my grandfather passed away in college too, so that was an upsetting time. I also feared that my mother could relapse because of his death. And
you had a lot on your shoulders in college again, which is a time that we like to think that folks are free and easy and just making choices about the rest of their life. Linda, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up right here. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation I'm having with Linda Baron Katz, who is the author of Surviving Mental Illness, My Story. She's also the co-author of Peter and Lisa, a mental illness children's story. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Linda, when you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and that was at the age of 24, you were out of college at that point. During your time in college and shortly after leaving college, were you aware of mood swings that you were experiencing? Were you aware of changes in how you were feeling?
I knew I was a depressed person, so the depression part I was a bit aware of. After I graduated college, my major was economics. I was always interested in working in the business, especially financial sector, banking. And I had a difficult time with getting interviewed, getting a job. My first job after 6 months was with an insurance company, and they hired and fired me in 3 days.
In 3 days?
And that was very upsetting. And you know what they fired me because?
What did they say?
I was too slow.
Too slow.
Too slow. And that upsetted me. And I found later on I did some temp work for a while. And it was good. I was just doing photocopying and filing, but I knew I wasn't getting anywhere. No one was going to promote me, and I started to rethink about my career goals, and I started to get depressed, coming home and to work depressed. The interviewing with other companies was not going so well, and I started to question, why is there something wrong with me, about me, that I'm not getting a job, that I'm not doing well on my interviews. I knew that from my gut inside, and one time I was hired by a stock brokerage firm, and he verbally harassed me, and he cursed me, and he did all things that's very unprofessional. My father and I took him to court, and we detailed. I kept the record of what he said, when he said it.
Good for you.
And you know, it was just a troubling time. And a couple of months afterwards, while I was volunteering at other places, trying to get a field of where I belong, so I volunteered at a community house and worked with the elderly a bit. And was around that time I started to get manic thoughts. I started to hear voices of the guy that I used to like in college. I believed things that he and I were engaged to be married and have his 5 children.
Did the voices, Linda, ever tell you to harm yourself?
No. Thank God, no. God I didn't have that. But it was mostly hearing his voice. And I heard other voices too. I remember going into my synagogue, in an Orthodox synagogue, and I heard a voice telling me, someone from the men's side, to come over. So I came over, went to the men's side, and in an Orthodox shul, you know, men and women sit separately. You're not allowed to go to the men's side.
Right.
Well, I went to the men's side, and then my father saw me in the men's side, and he dragged me out and said, Linda, what are you doing? I didn't know where I was. And then I remember having a manic phase where I was sitting on my parents' sofa, and I heard or thought I heard people praying to me outside my window, and they weren't just ordinary. They were from Queens College Hillel people, the club I used to be involved in. Mm-hmm. I thought I heard their voices praying to me as if I was some kind of special prophet or messiah. And, you know, I must have scared my sister very badly then. I scared my parents. My father knew from his experience with my mother what was wrong with me. He begged Dr. Nass to take me as his patient, which he did. And Dr. Nass diagnosed me with bipolar. And when I first saw Dr. Nass, I said to myself, great, I am like my mother. And you know what he said? You are not your mother. You are you. I can never tell you, can never forget those words.
That is so important. That's so important.
And, you know, it was then that I decided, you know, I don't want to end up like my mother. What can I do to change? And I decided that, you know, I want to work. I don't want to be like my mother who hated working. I'm young. So I enrolled myself in a VESET program, vocational for people with disabilities, and they sent me to a supported employment program. I also struggled very hard to get Social Security disability, and finally got it through a judge, so it was very difficult. Got denied 3 times.
Oh my.
Until a judge finally, you know, accepted it. And VESET sent me to a supported employment program. And
Linda, can you describe what a supported employment program is for folks who don't know?
Yeah, that's a vocational program to help people with mental illness. Well, this is just for mental health, people with mental illness. And they help you look for a job, search on your job based on your interests, your needs. And they help you with your resume. They job coach you on interviews. They have group workshops. They train you on the computer. You know, it depends. And at first I was interested in clerical. And I had a little jobs for 1 or 2 days, and then I got into an employment program called Transitional Services of New York, and they were the best for me. I liked them so much because the groups that they run, the resume help, the job coaching, and through that, I heard that Bramson Ord College was hiring tutors. So I set forth an interview with Bramson Ord, and they hired me as a tutor for people with ESL, English as a Second Language. And it was very good. And then I got promoted to work for the clerical department for students and faculty. And I was there for a long time, 3 years, until because of budget cuts, they had to lay me off. And then during those years, I decided, you know, I think people often tell me, why don't you go and become a peer specialist? I didn't know what that was. I wasn't sure whether I would do well in the mental health. But I realized that's the thing where I was going to be headed. And after I got married, I started to look for something in the mental health. And my first, and I, luckily, I had a neighbor of mine who lived downstairs, and she worked for PSCH.
What's that?
It's a disability organization for people with developmental and psychiatric.
Okay.
And I got interviewed, and the human resources person asked me, would you like to be a peer counselor? I said, yes. So I was interviewed by an assertive community treatment team, and I got hired, and it was great. Now, of course, my dad didn't like the fact of the job that I was doing, because it involved me going to homeless shelters, visit people's apartments in their homes. You know, that thing, I admit, I did like least.
But well, it was so different.
It really developed my self-esteem, and I led groups. I conducted groups on vocational and symptom management, on medication issues, on housing issues, and I even helped people get housing, helped with their benefits, and I liked it, but I also thought that the place wasn't really fit for me, but it gave me the experience I was looking for.
Absolutely. I mean, the experiences were so different from what you grew up with. I could kind of understand your father being a little uneasy about you getting involved in that kind of work and those kinds of different communities. Let me ask you this. You frequently refer to the fact that you were raised as an Orthodox Jewish person. Did that have a particular impact on you, particularly in light of the mental illness you were dealing with?
Yes. When I was single and dating, I found it more difficult because at first I didn't want someone with a mental illness in my family. I said, I have enough of it. But and as I dated Orthodox men, no, I got into the habit of, my father always thought I was raising a flag because I told a lot of people about my mental illness, that I had manic depression, bipolar. And what my father didn't understand was I was educating the community. And even so, I noticed that with the Orthodox Jewish community, it was a tight-knit society. And when I told the person about my mental illness, the men would run away from me. They would ask me questions. Can you hold down a job? Can you raise children? Can you handle this? Can you handle that? I mean, and that those questions were so overwhelming, and I felt like I was being interrogated. And the stigma was really bad. So, and then my therapist, as I saw my therapist, she said, why don't you find someone who has also a mental illness with someone similar? I said, but that's enough of it in my family. Like, I had my own stigma issues to deal with.
Right, you didn't want another.
Right. But I decided to take on her off, and so I got involved with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I found myself with the Friendship Network. And my father was horrified that I became involved in NAMI and everything. But I did. And I I got set up with a few Jewish people. Some were Orthodox, but they all had mental illness. And we went on trips. We went on outings and picnics. And it was a lot of fun.
Sounds wonderful.
And finally, I decided that I needed to go back to the Orthodox Jewish community. But this time, I went about it differently. I decided to educate them. And I convinced the rabbi to hold an event for dealing with stigma of the mentally ill challenged. And I got even the Jewish Week to write an article about the event. And I got speakers from an organization called Community Access. And these people all had some form of mental illness. And it was really great. Over 40 people came.
Wonderful.
And I was really proud, and I got my picture to be in the paper and everything. And it was the first one that was ever hosted in an Orthodox shul.
Linda, it just takes so much courage. I mean, I listen to what your life has been like, and you've certainly had more than your fair share of challenges, but then to have the thought and the energy and the courage and the wisdom to go to your rabbi and say, this is something that we need in this community, let me do this. And then you were able to get so many people and organizations there. You really should be incredibly proud of yourself. That's extraordinary.
Thank you. I am, because I now know why God gave me the mental illness. It was to help people, to help raise awareness, to help eliminate the stigma of mental illness, and to give people hope. And I'm happy. And not too long ago, I also... one of my friends I met at my synagogue wanted me to go out with this guy, set me up with someone. So this is when I met my husband, Charles. We went out on a date, and I knew something was wrong with him, but I couldn't picture it. And we went on a date, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to see him or not, so I kept his number, stayed friends with him. We went out again in the second month, and he gave me a bracelet and a watch or something, I don't know. And I felt that the relationship was going too fast, so I had my doubts about him, and we stayed friends, and we were dating on and off for 5 years.
Oh, my goodness. Linda, let's take a break, and when we come back, I need you to let us know how you went from dating off and on to actually getting married. We'll be right we'll be right back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Linda, you went from thinking it was going too fast when you saw him a month later to actually going out with him for 5 years before you got married?
Yeah. I wasn't sure about him, and I had, we had the Shabbaton gathering that my shul had, and he came to the Shabbaton, and we got to talking. He walked me back home one night, and we got to talking, and he asked me if I ever did any strange things. So I started telling him a little bit about my mental illness, and he said, I also have a mental illness. I also suffer. I suffer from depression, dysthymia. And we talked...
Dysthymia is a form of depression.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talked, that's when I began to start to really like him. And because he had similar diagnosis and he understood me and I wasn't afraid that he would leave me, but I still had some doubts afterwards. So it wasn't until when my mother suffered from cancer that I started to think of him seriously, that he is the only one who really had any interest. He knew he wanted me right away. And
so how long did you make him wait?
Yeah. So when my mom got sick with cancer, I started to date him in a serious level. I even introduced him to my parents, and he met my mother, and he met my father, and they liked him. But I can assure you, if I didn't have a mental illness, my father would never let me go out with him. That I can tell you. That's how prejudiced my dad was a bit.
Interesting.
And he was there with me when my mom got sick, when I had to go to the hospital. He came one time and spent a weekend with me in the hospital where they had rooms. Private rooms for people who visited their sick parents. And he was really supportive in every way.
It sounds like it. It really does. He really loved you and showed you in so many ways.
Yes. And when my mom passed away, they went every night to the Shiva. Every night he came by. And, you know, he had a mustache in the beginning, and I don't like people with mustaches. I said to Child, you have to do something about this, because I had difficulty kissing him. So one of the days of my mom's Shiva period, he came in, and I saw him and then said, you shaved your mustache. I said it out loud. I felt so embarrassed. I was so happy that I calmed down because my father didn't like it. But and then we dated a couple of months, and then his mom got also sick with cancer. And his mom died that same year, a couple of months later. And his mother told him, give her your grandmother's ring. He was ready to propose to me. And we went driving, and he parked his car one area, and he gave the ring to me. And it wasn't the most romantic place. I thought he was going to take me to dine out in a nice restaurant, but he proposed in the car. And it was great. I took him to see my father, and at that time, my father knew we were serious, and he also had a few requirements in order for Charles to marry me.
Your dad had requirements?
Yeah.
What were they?
A prenuptial agreement.
Okay.
My husband didn't understand that. My father told me not to tell him about it.
Well, he'd have to know at some point.
Yeah. So Charles got very upset. He almost lit a fuse. And he almost was going to go and leave. I said, please don't leave. And my father calmed him down. And then he spoke to his father on the phone, and he calmed him down. And everything was like, but I was scared that he was going to leave me and break my heart.
And, you know, a lot of times when prenuptial agreements are introduced, that is what happens. So, you know, again, it sounds like the two of you were really quite well matched. He cared about you, you cared about him, and the two of you had been through almost the worst of things even before you became married. And today, you are happily married.
Yes, I am. You proud are. To be his wife. And he supports me in every way possible. He encourages my dreams and everything. And without him, I don't know where I'd be. And he encouraged me to write a book. And he was also there for me when my father was dying, and that was a traumatic time. There was also a traumatic time that we both experienced. I wanted children very badly. And we had trouble. We had infertility problems. Mm. And when I finally got pregnant through insemination, and it was a tough 5 months. And my father gave me one of the worst depressions. He kept accusing Charles's family of having birth defects, birth problems.
Oh, no.
Said certain things about his sister, why he didn't have, they didn't have children, why thought something was wrong with his sister. And then he thought something was wrong with his hands because he's got a carpal tunnel. And I kept saying to Dad, that is from his work. And he wasn't born with it. Of course, he didn't believe me. And he just gave me one of the worst depressions. And I couldn't come out of it. And nurses told me, the doctors told me, you have to stop crying so much, it'll affect the fetus. I wasn't sure to what degree it would affect the fetus. I took an amniocentesis, and they found out that there was not enough amniotic fluid the fetus was getting, and the baby wasn't growing. And I was told that I might have to terminate it. And of course, I didn't want to have to terminate it. But there was no way the fetus would survive, and I didn't want it to end stillborn. So I terminated the pregnancy, but it was a tough 5 months.
Oh, Linda, it sounds so painful. And I'm so sorry your dad couldn't find a way to be there and be supportive of you. Clearly, Charles was there for you and you for him, but I'm so sorry that the two of you had to go through that.
Yes, and to this day, I still have doubts that I wonder if my father didn't give me that depression, would the baby be alive? I still have doubts. Maybe I should have let it miscarry on my own, then it would just be God's decision. But I didn't do that. And
Is that something you're talking with your therapist about now?
Not so much. That was then. At the time, I talked about it with my therapist. She was there for me every day. And but sometimes I talk about it with her.
That's good.
So if I didn't have my psychiatrist and therapist, I don't know where I'd be. I'd probably be still sick. But thank God I had a support system. And I had friends who supported me.
Linda, for people who are listening right now to your voice and are having similar experiences, perhaps it's bipolar, perhaps it's another form of depression, what would you like for them to learn or to know from your story?
I'd like for them to know that they shouldn't be afraid of mental illness, that recovery is possible. Recovery can mean different things to many people. In my experience, I wanted to work, and I considered working as a significant part of my recovery. But it can mean many things to different people. You don't have to work full time in order to achieve your goals. You can focus on one goal at a time, whether if it's losing weight, or whether if it's exercising every day, or whether if it's finding a hobby, or reading a book, or volunteering. Just do something productive, something out there. And I hope that my story today gives people that kind of hope. And I hope it teaches people who do not have mental illness to understand that mental illness is not the cause of violence. And there are many people with mental illness who are not violent.
It's very true.
And they should know that hopefully they can learn to erase whatever prejudices or stigmas or things they heard about mental illness that are not true, and learn from it and learn about someone's story. And that's what I hope my story brings. And I hope it brings hope to many people who have mental illness, who are struggling with their recovery. And you can achieve many goals in life, and you can recover and can get better. But seeing a psychiatrist and a therapist and taking your medication is a top number one priority. And you have to stick with that in order to get better, in order for life, for you to improve your life. And medication alone is not enough. You need to work on yourself. You need to improve on yourself. And that's why having a therapist and support is so much better. And you need both the medication and the support system. And
I am so appreciative of everything that you're saying and everything that you've done in your life, and certainly what you've been willing to share with us today.
Thank you.
Folks, Linda Baron Katz is the author of Surviving Mental Illness, My Story, and she is the co-author, I believe, with your husband. Is that correct, Linda?
Yes, with my husband.
And this is a story about Peter and Lisa. It is a mental illness children's story. And you don't want your lives, if there's mental illness in your home and your family, you don't want your lives to be what Linda's was like, where no one ever talked about it, and so no one ever understood. And the more you don't talk about it, the more fearful it becomes. Linda, again, I thank you very much for joining us today and for telling us your story of survival.
Thank you. And let me just add one thing.
Yes.
Recovery is all about living life. And life is worth living. every day.
Thank you for that, Linda. And again, folks, the name of Linda's book is Surviving Mental Illness, My Story. And the children's book is Peter and Lisa, A Mental Illness Children's Story. So thank you, Linda, for creating both of those. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, my email is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, the website for Linda's book is Surviving Mental Illness, and each word is separated by a hyphen. And I encourage you to take a look at Linda's website and see what you decide to do from there. And again, Linda, I want to thank you, and certainly NAMI. NAMI is an excellent organization. I frequently refer folks to them. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I very much appreciate, Linda, the work you're doing with them.
Thank you.
And again, folks, thank you, and please remember always, if it's unacceptable, that is precisely what it is, unacceptable. You take care, folks.